It's a privilege for me to introduce to you our guest speaker, Dr. Lee Bartel. I was lucky to have the opportunity to listen to him talk this morning at the Center on Aging, hosted by Dr. Scott Hofer. And to say that he's engaging and knowledgeable and passionate about his craft is a definite understatement. Indeed, trying to take in all of his presentation and assimilate it is like drinking from a fire hose. To begin at the beginning, Dr. Bartel hails from Steinbeck, Manitoba, but makes his home now in Toronto. He is the professor of music education and associate dean of research at the Faculty of Music at the University of Toronto. Dr. Bartel is the acting director of the Music and Health Research Collaboratory, and he has a cross appointment to the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. He received his PhD at the University of Illinois College of Education in 1988, and he is a musician, educator, scientist, musiholic, essentially a cognitive bon vivant. He has taught at the elementary and high school level, but spends a lot of his time now teaching at the graduate level in research methodology, music and the brain, evaluation and social psychology of music. His research has taken him into countless directions. His CV is the size of a Bible. And this research of his includes areas of neurologic maladies like maladies of modern day society, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, tinnitus, heart health, just to name a few. So for those of you who have read Malcolm Gladwell's book on The Tipping Point, Dr. Bartel is the quintessential maven and connector. Dr. Bartel will be presenting the science and the power of music. Dr. Bartel, thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Lafayette Quartet, for the invitation to be here. It's a pleasure to be on in this lovely city and staying where we are close to the water and recovering from the density of Toronto in this lovely place. My task is not easy being the last speaker in this group because you've heard amazing information already and inspiring videos and pictures, and Joanna's done an incredible job of showing you what the power of music is with the lives of real people and real kids who are needy, who have incredible potential, and who deserve to have the ability to express themselves and to enjoy, participate in the wonders of music. So what I'm going to talk about is probably a little on the more dull and academic side. But, you know, you have to have some of that as well. When I did my doctoral work in the 1980s, I was struggling with a topic, and it grew right out of my experience working with choirs and churches, where I found that everybody had an opinion about how music should go. And it seemed no matter what I did, somebody was always unhappy. And so I started looking at how people differ in their intellectual and emotional response to music. And is that something that in fact varies from person to person? Because the person who wants to be moved and you want to feel the magical power of the expressive qualities of music and perhaps even just the beat and the groove of the music, and then you have the others who want to be elevated and think great thoughts and have the magical, well, not magical because that wouldn't be too far, but the elevated space of great art, and suddenly the two cannot really talk to each other. And what I found at that point was that this differs person to person and heavily related to personality. And I tested it with personality tests and found, lo and behold, the Myers-Briggs does explain quite a bit of this. And what I found for music students, those of you who are, is that we basically educate the joy of music right out of you because we teach you entirely to be critical and intellectual. And although you entered this profession because you loved the emotional experience, and your polyvagal system was animated and your adrenal system was activated when you played it, suddenly it was all about making critical judgments and being adjudicators. And the fun of music just sort of deteriorated. So when I started moving in the direction of the sort of the scientific study of music and how to move brainwave activity and so on, it started with an opportunity to work with music therapists and neuropsych people to rehabilitate attention in kids who had had front head injuries. I started to realize that there were other ways of looking at music, and what we really needed to do was start to understand the various ways that music's effect was experienced and the way that music could be looked at not just from the sort of global power effect, but rather are there very specific dimensions which connect to very specific ways that music works. And so that took me into this dull direction that I'm now going. So what I've tried to create is a model that explains not the topics that you could possibly consider, you know, music with kids, music with older people, music with dementia, music with etc. It doesn't explain, and I won't show many, you know, pictures of brain images that shows where you know, Sting's brain gets activated when he gets stuck in the MRI machine by Dan Levitin. That may be interesting to some people, but in my opinion, it was really quite irrelevant. It demonstrated more about Dan Levitin's jazz improvisation ability than it did about other things. And so I started to wonder what really would help us develop a better agenda for research and understand what we're trying to do when we make progress in understanding why music is powerful. Many of you have probably seen the movie Alive Inside. Dan Cohen initiated the iPod project some years ago, and when we did a screening in Toronto of the movie Alive Inside, we had him there and several other noted clinicians, and we had a discussion like this at the end of the movie. And somebody asked a question, and he said, Dan Cohen said, I'm not so interested in why it works. I just am interested that it works. And I thought to myself, well, yes, from an experiential standpoint, from an evidence-based standpoint, that is true. That's. But as a scientist, I have to keep asking why. Why does the iPod work in that way? And if we can start to understand that, maybe we can make some progress in more specifically tailoring our treatment to people in particular ways. So here's my effort at trying to put that together. So essentially I've created a four-level model of response activation. So it's response to music. How do we respond to music? Not what are the topics involved. So the first level, a friend of mine, Dennis Simons, is a medical doctor in charge of four nursing homes. And before the iPod project, he told us this story saying that he had this one patient who originated from India, who had dementia, and around 4 o'clock after every afternoon, she became very agitated, somewhat aggressive, difficult to manage. The nurses weren't sure what to do with her. And so he didn't want to drug people unnecessarily. He was trying to find ways to treat people without adding drugs. And so it occurred to him that if he asked the family to bring a tape, and this was in the days of tapes, of music from her youth, from India, put earphones on, and lo and behold, she settled right down. And the agitation ceased. And he wrote it into her program of care so that around 4 o'clock, put earphones on this lady, put on her music, her tape of Indian music, and it lasted for a long time until they lost the prescription of care and she was back. And he had to rewrite it again. Why does that work? Well, it works for the same reason many other things that we've seen work. That is, one of the very basic things we learn from the time we're born, even before we realize we're learning it, is an associative and emotional response to music. Music activates the limbic system in ways that other things doesn't. It activates the polyvagal system in ways that many other things doesn't. And so we make connections, and these on a blatant level are things like, that's our song, that music is creates a political or a nationalist feeling like our national anthem, that's wedding music, this is happy music, that's sad music. And we have learned those associations, and we know this because you go to another culture, and what they hear as happy music, we may be hearing as sad music. This varies culture to culture. Music is not a universal language, it's a universal means of expression. And so, as a language, it differs somewhat. And we make all these associations, and that forms the core of how we listen and hear and choose and react. These functions are very important, useful for therapy, because they lead us to the point of engaging kids and what you and people. You saw this sort of powerful engagement that people develop with music when they can play the drum, when they can connect to it in some way. It's a means of communication, so they suddenly have a voice to communicate at all sorts of levels of ability, and it serves in that way. And all of these other ways in which music is activated in this kind of way that music therapists are masters at, and I so admire the work that is done by music therapists. Another level, which is earlier than we remember, is that we have encoded isomorphic and primal learnings. So this is just a dotted line between these. It goes deeper into the brain as I go into the model. Before the child is born, they have spent months listening. And what have they been listening to? They've been listening strongly to they've been listening to the mother's heartbeat, and it sounds about like that when you actually hear a recording from the womb. That has given them an unbelievable sense of stability. So suddenly they're out of the womb and they're not hearing that anymore. So Fred Schwartz, a friend through the International Association of Music Medicine, who's a doctor in Piedmont Hospital in Atlanta, decided many years ago that if he recorded the mother's heartbeat and played it in the neonatal unit, maybe the kids would be happier. And lo and behold, that's what happened. We found out later that these kids have not just learned that the heartbeat is a comforting thing, they can actually identify their specific mother by the heart rate variability in that heartbeat. So that's beyond what any of us could. Their rhythmic perceptual learning abilities of these kids that young is unbelievable. Sandra Treva has tested kids before the age of 5 and found that their ability at polyrhythmic processing is beyond anything that of most people in this room, other than, you know, the string quartet and a few other advanced musicians. They lose that ability if it's not actively pursued and developed, because the neural system just says, well, we don't need these neurons that were going to be used for that, so we'll get rid of them, and we'll just slough them off. So this, the other is the isomorphic learning, which is that we learn very quickly there's a one-to-one relationship between things. When we're excited, we move quickly. Our legs go boom, 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 boom. When music goes boom, 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 we associate it with that excitement. When we're tired and depressed, our legs tend to move more slowly. When we hear music that moves more slowly, we associate it with that reaction. Same thing with a slower heartbeat or faster heartbeat. So this combined response accounts for much of the power of music and much of what music therapy does. Not the topics, but the mechanism. And what I'm trying to get at here is the actual mechanisms in the brain and our body that are the focus for research pursuits, and that differentiate one study from another. You saw the video of Gabby Giffords, the congresswoman from Arizona who was shot through the head. The Canadian story is Allison, in the book Allison's Brain. Some of you may have heard the CBC Ideas program in February, where they focused on Allison, a music teacher in Ottawa who had a brain aneurysm, lost her ability to speak, and many other things. Cheryl Jones, music therapist who was trained in neurologic music therapy, worked with her and brought back her ability to speak. What she was doing and what was happening here with melodic intonation therapy was a form of neurologic music therapy, or using specific cognitive neural channels to access things that other channels weren't producing. So when you're trying to access your language lexicon and processing system in your Broca and Wernicke's area, and there's a bullet that has gone through between that and the center of the brain, it's a bit hard for the system to access that lexicon. What we find is that the music channel to process words is different from your normal language channel, and so we sort of have a back door to get to that through the music system. It's not a redundant system, it's a different system. There are different systems for all sorts of things. Neurologic music therapy, Michael Tout, in his approach, has created some 20 different protocols to address things related to motor movement, to linguistic processing, and so on. So the knowledge of specific cognitive channels for processing information related to music allows us to target music in that way. So it's very important in rehabilitation in all of these areas I've already mentioned. There's another level. We're getting deeper into the brain now and less cognitive, less thought related, less intentional. And this is the rhythmic driving of neural activity. When I do this, your ears were hearing that, and something in your auditory processing system was leading to a neural firing into the auditory cortex so you could process that and hear that. No single neuron does anything in the brain, so there were a whole lot of neurons not being used for much, and many people have neurons that do basically nothing. They just sort of hang around there. So there's something going on, and they say, wow, there's excitement happening here. Let's join in this little dance. So there are a whole lot of neurons were suddenly firing when I did this. It could have been picked up all over your cortex with EEG sensing, because they were all just joining in the chorus and starting their oscillation, their firing together in rhythmic coherence. When we do this at this speed, we find that people with Parkinson's can suddenly walk more easily. The exact mechanism I could perhaps discuss with Brian and we could dispute, but what I've seen with my own EEG analysis is that within 15 seconds, and sometimes, and that's how fast I see it, it's probably faster, I'm seeing a response in the cerebellum that is involved heavily in coordinating muscular movement. When I do this with musicians, I see exactly the same thing. They don't even have to hear a sound to fire it. Their brain immediately just starts to respond to that rhythm, which they're just seeing visually, because they've so made that connection between what the conductor does and what a rhythm does and the sound. That then connects the parts of the brain that are involved in motion and makes it happen. We can all do this at various speeds. We can do this quite slowly at 2 times per second. We can embed that in music, like the notes that move in a slow movement of a Bach slow movement, and that will boost what happens twice per second in your brain, which is deep sleep delta waves. And it's not surprising why a lot of you go to sleep during slow movements in concerts. It's not the string quartet's fault, it's purely what's happening in your brain. We can do this at 10 times a second, and if we did it just like this, it would sound manic and you'd think it's very energizing. But if we embed that in music with a harp arpeggiation, it starts to sound really relaxing. And what you're doing is nudging the brain to a 10 times a second pulsation associated with alpha and relaxation. If we do it 40 times a second, it'll sound like a low note, like an E or an E flat on the piano. Or a double bass, rather, because the piano doesn't really have a fundamental. But it's going to drive 40 pulsations in the brain. It's hard to do with earphones, usually done with a vibratory chair, but we can do it with earphones if we take a carrier sound, like 160 hertz, take the E up a couple of octaves, and then start and stop it 40 times a second. with amplitude modulation. And suddenly you have that A, that E has a low growl to it. One of my students tried this with Elvis. His grandmother, I think, had had a stroke, and he thought her processing was slowed, and her spatial connections, and he was using a standardized test in which she did a drawing replica. And so he took her favorite music, Elvis, put it through amplitude modulation 40 times a second, so Elvis now had a growl to it, and played this to her for 15 minutes. It still sounded like Elvis, except that it had this low growl in it. When he did the test again, it is remarkable how much better that drawing was, because he had changed the cognitive processing of her brain with that frequency. So sound can drive rhythmic activity in the brain. I could go on explaining that. But here's a graph from a study which we reported for the first time on Tuesday this week, and it has not yet been submitted to for publication. And what we did here was we took 18 people with Alzheimer's, six with mild, six with middle or medium kind of, and six with severe. And we sat them on a chair with six subwoofers in the chair and played 40 hertz sine wave to them for 25 minutes, twice a week for 3 weeks. We did nothing else. Then we flipped them over to another 3 weeks in which they sat in the very same chair in the very same room and watched a video without sound. And what happened was, and others were, this was a randomized study, so some started with the video and went to the music, some went started with the music with a sound and went to the video, is that over the six sessions, the people with this vibration increased their SLUMS, the St. Louis University measurement, so it's a standardized Alzheimer's test, with an effect size of 0.581. There's more than half a point of score per session in a steady incline. What we saw qualitatively is that they became more cognitively clear, became more engaged in conversation about things outside and around them, told more stories, and related and connected more to the therapist. And by the third week, some of them were saying, oh, I remember doing this before. In other words, we had shifted their cognitive process by stimulating them with 40 hertz. The full detail of this goes into much more complicated, but it ties back to a finding in the 90s that when a person develops Alzheimer's, their 40 hertz component of gamma deteriorates. And what we were doing is stimulating and driving it back up. It also appears to be the frequency that's involved strongly intra-brain communication, and so short-term to long-term memory and consciousness was somehow stimulated. The full details of it we don't completely understand. In the slums, it basically stayed flat or in fact deteriorated a bit. We did a study in which we used this walking pulse with people in cardio rehab. They get their prescription to walk, let's say, a 16-minute mile. We paced them to look at how many steps they took in order to walk a 16-minute mile. We found music that was at that metronome marking that pace. One third of the group, we said, just do what you're doing. We didn't suggest music. The next group, we asked them to bring in their playlist. We selected music was that at that tempo. The third group, we took that same music from their playlist, and we punched up the beat with extra sound. We added an extra cymbal sound or a drum sound, whatever seemed appropriate to the music so it didn't stick out as a doctored effect. But we could see it in the MP3 editor and gave them that music in a blinded study. What we found is that the people, the control, they just sort of puddled along. They made a little bit of improvement. The people with the playlist sort of got a little bit better. They weren't all that great. The people with our punched up music made dramatic improvement. And the most important dramatic improvement was not just during their exercise that it was more vigorous. It was throughout the day. They were wearing activity monitors for 24 hours a day. They were more active during the rest of the time during the weeks that this was involved, and they became more active. we change their brain in the direction of facilitating movement. So rhythmic auditory stimulation, RAS, is involved in cognitive tract muscle response, RSS, rhythmic sensory stimulation, which is what we did with the Alzheimer's, can also be applied at various levels. Sleep inducement, we did at Mount Sinai, and it can correct dysrhythmias in the brain. Finally, at the sensory cellular, or I should probably now add at the genetic level, a study just came out 2 months ago or so that showed that people who perform music, like the string quartet, have seen gene expression change in some 70 different genes, including several genes that are involved in neurogenesis. And so these people have altered themselves, their human development, by playing music. And most of these are positive, like it has accentuated the genes, others have suppressed some genes. So we have to look very carefully at the profile. But performing, working with music, changes at the genetic level. There was a study done in Japan about 3 or 4 years ago in which they took brain cells and subjected them to a variety of frequencies and found that at 40 hertz, these cells grew, extended as in Brian's forest, most actively. We think it may be involved with Alzheimer's, but our 3-week period was too short to really think there was anything like neurogenesis, but if we did it for 6 months or a year, perhaps. Ladan Yu, a member of my research center, stimulated bone cells with vibration and found that bone cells grew greater density. If you have osteoporosis, you may want to get one of these vibrating platforms, set it at, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 hertz, and just vibrate yourself silly. just might be involved in that. At this vibration level, we also know that from research from vibroacoustic therapy, that it improves circulation, it decreases pain for various reasons, increases mobility, decreases blood pressure, and all of these are also related to a mechanical stimulation of the body and this driving effect. So, do all of these levels function at the same time with music? Probably. So from a cellular, making your bones grow and your brain cells grow to the point where it's making connections from when you were young and that music, just as when I met my boyfriend, all of those things happen simultaneously and make it extremely powerful. So music is indeed powerful. We can study it scientifically if we could take it apart. Some people find that very boring and destructive, but I find it very exciting because it leads me to a whole lot of research studies that I can start to understand the mechanism and not just the general effect. Thank you.